All right. Hello, everyone. Good to see you. Hi, Ann and Kate together. as Don just mentioned, in a few weeks, the guiding light is going to go down to half an hour, and Shauna will then follow me on Sunday nights with half an hour. And again, it was a good time to do that because I'm almost at the end of this book, as she mentioned. I'm on page 101. And the last page of this book is 107. So we're getting pretty dang close to the end of the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. The Guiding Light is officially a book study with Regina. That's really what this time is. And so there will be a new book selected after Ramana Maharshi. I think I already know what it is, but I'm not going to tell you yet, just in case it changes. But since we're getting near the end of the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, we're going to honor Ramana tonight with our opening song. This is by Krishna Das, and you're going to see lots and lots of pictures of Arunachala and Ramana Ashram in the video as it plays. So.
Yeah.
Life magazine, and that what appears to be a cute little girl in the front is actually Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a child. I'm not quite sure why his mom addressed him that way. But the reason I grabbed this 1949 Life magazine, let me see if I can find the table of contents. There's an article in here about Ramana Maharshi. Let's see, where is it? It's kind of funny though. I'll just show you some of the, here's a bacon commercial. Isn't it funny to look at these old ads? A bacon ad. Yeah, this is the only Antique Life magazine that I have, and obviously the reason I ordered it was for Ramana Maharshi. Oh, here we go. Here's the table of contents. The name of the article, I think, is Holy Man, and it's by a guy named Winthrop Sargent. It's on page 92 of this magazine. Ah, okay. I'll have to pull it back a little bit. There's, can you see? That's in Life magazine. See Ramana Maharshi with all the people around him? Isn't that cool? So there's an article in Life magazine about Ramana Maharshi. Here's some more pictures. Here's a picture of him on the mountain. And here is a picture of a bunch of people, you know, that have just gone to see him. And what you can see is a mixture of Westerners and Indians in the crowd. And this is the pool next to Ashram. Those of us who have been there know this pool, and then the mountain in the background. And what else do we have here? Oh, wow, look at this. This is the gate of Sri Ramana Ashram, possibly on Deepam. Look how crowded it is. How many people are there? Right, this 1949. See if there's any other pictures. Oh, yeah. Here is, it says, beside the office safe. This is Sri Ramana's brother keeps strict accounts and controls the ashram's organization with a shrewd and wary eye for business. Now, look how much his brother looks like him, except that he's all business looking. But look at his face. That's his brother. He was the ashram manager. So pretty cool magazine. And we were just looking at, oh, what's this? This is a plaster statue of Sri Ramana. This article goes on and on for pages. A plaster statue of Sri Ramana as a young man. That's no longer there, I don't think. I haven't seen that. And down here, this is just the temple dome, the temple there in Tiruvannamalai, one of the many domes. So if anybody wants a cool old, oh, look at this. Here's the whole temple. Now let's see, let me get the right picture in front. There's the whole temple. Can you see it? Oops, my magazine's falling apart showing it to you. There's the temple. And then this picture is... this is a mythological statue near Sri Ramana Ashram. And I'm going to have to quit showing you now because my precious magazine is falling apart, holding it up to the camera like this. It talks right here. Look at this. You see that subtitle? Who am I? I mean, it really talks about his teachings. Isn't this cool? Who knew that? Whoops. Sorry, I didn't mean to rip my magazine. And then they have a little bit about Aurobindo, who lived at the same time. So, yeah. So that was May 30, 1949. So if anybody likes to collect old magazines, that's one you might want to collect. I keep it here in this little... of course, I just now ripped the heck out of it, but I keep it in this protective plastic. So I won't do things like that. I won't rip it anymore. If I do, oh well. But it's fun. It's fun to have. Okay, so So we are here for the last chapter. We're continuing the last chapter, which is called Aham and Ahamvrtti. Aham was I am. I've already forgotten what Ahamvrtti was. Let's see. Where can I find it? Oh, here it is, the I thought. The I thought. So the I am and the I thought is basically the name of this chapter in English. And we're starting at the very bottom of page 101 with a question from the devotee. The question still remains, why the quest for the source of the I thought as distinguished from other thoughts should be considered the direct means to self-realization? And I think we started this maybe last week. The question sounds familiar, but maybe didn't finish it because it's a long answer. Ramana Maharshi says, we read this first paragraph. I remember this. The word aham, which means I am, is itself very suggestive. The two letters of the word, namely ah and ha, are the first and last letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. The suggestion intended to be conveyed by the word is that it comprises all. How? Because aham signifies existence itself. Right? I am signifies existence itself. And we talked about that last week. So now we're getting into new stuff now. Although the concept of I-ness or I am-ness is by usage known as the I thought, it is not really a thought like the other thoughts of the mind. Because unlike the other thoughts, which have no essential interrelation, the I thought is equally and essentially related to each and every thought of the mind. Without the I thought, there can be no other thoughts. But the I thought can subsist by itself without depending on any other thought of the mind. The I thought is therefore fundamentally different from other thoughts. So this is really important. And I remember now last week's discussion. This is when we got into Buddhist hell, and it's time that we return there. And again, the term Buddhist hell refers to a place that you get in meditation where it seems like all thoughts have stopped. It's completely quiet, very, very peaceful. And a lot of people, when they reach this state, think that's it. Right? That's enlightenment. And in fact, if you've seen the movie Revolver, which I know many of you have seen, in Revolver, there's in the elevator scene where the ego dies, just before the ego dies, there's this brief period of time when it looks like the ego has died. It gets all quiet, right? And Jake kind of looks around and then the ego jumps back up and goes, aha, you know, still here. but that's why that state is called Buddhist hell, is because the ego is actually still there. The I thought, the sense of self, is actually still there. And that's what Ramana Maharshi is really talking about in this particular paragraph. He says that for all other thoughts to appear, the I thought has to be there. But the I thought is not dependent on all other thoughts. All other thoughts could, you know, subside, and the I thought could still, you know, have its grasp on you. So that's an interesting thing. This is why, you know, when we reach that state of quiet peace, we want to continue to inquire what sees this. Or who sees this? Because we want to keep going, keep going, keep going until the I thought itself ends. And the funny thing about that is I cannot tell you what that experience is, because it hasn't ended for me. But what I can tell you is, well, first of all, in NTI, there's a line in NTI that says something about continue to search for truth until you are the truth, until you are the truth. And I remember when I heard that, there was just this feeling that when you reach that point, you know it. And notice it doesn't say until you see the truth. It says until you are the truth. So one who is aware of silence and peace, right? There's still a me that's aware of this silence and peace. So it's not done yet, which is why they call that state Buddhist hell, right? Because people get, you know, they think they're awake and they're not. They're still stuck in the I thought state. And so again, we'll look at what Ramana Maharshi is saying. He says, although the concept of I-ness or I am-ness is by usage known as I thought, it is not really a thought like the other thoughts of the mind. So let me say something else about that. The other thoughts of the mind, you know, like if I'm sitting here thinking, oh, shoot, I tore my Ramana Maharshi magazine. Dang it, this magazine was so hard to find, right? Those thoughts have words to them, right? And that's what most thoughts have. And some thoughts have images. You know, you'll see like a vision. You'll see an image in your mind. The I thought isn't like that. The I thought is more a sense of self. A sense of I, a sense of, you know, whether you call it a sense of I, a sense of me, or a sense of I am, it is a sense of self. So instead of being words, you know, like other thoughts are, or images, it's a sense. It's a feeling that I exist. Right? So it's fundamentally different from all other thoughts. And yet it is the first error, the first mistake, you know, the first fall away from the absolute was into the sense of self, the sense of I, the sense of existence. So that's what Ramana Maharshi means when he says it's different from other thoughts. Right? It's not the same as other thoughts, even though we still call it a thought. And why do we still call it a thought? It's a divine creative idea. Right? The absolute could have the idea of itself as a self. Does that make sense? And remember, at the level of the I thought, although most of us tend to think of the I thought as the person thought, the I thought is actually higher than the person thought. In fact, the person thought can die. The person thought can end. And you might call that the first awakening. And you awaken to consciousness. And yet consciousness still has a sense of self about it. Not separate self. You know, people describe consciousness as unity. But it still has a sense of self. It still has a sense of I am. And so that sense of self, even at the consciousness level, needs to be obliterated in order to awaken to the absolute. So you can definitely say that the I thought is prior to all other thoughts. In fact, you can say that the I thought is prior to creation itself, right? Creation meaning the creation of form, the creative principle. So if you're looking at Regina's four principles of God, the absolute is the first principle of God. The I thought would come into being at the second principle of God. Right? The I thought as a sense of consciousness, as a sense of self. So the person is way down at the fourth principle of God. However, it's not completely a mistake to think of the I thought as the person, because that's the first thing that needs to go. So it's kind of like you release the sense of personal self, and then you release the entire sense of self and awaken to the absolute, right? So although the concept of I-ness or I-am-ness is by usage known as I thought, it is not really a thought like the other thoughts of the mind. Because unlike the other thoughts, which have no essential interrelation, and of course, you know, what he means by that is, you know, if you watch your mind for a little while, you'll see it thinks about everything, and there's not necessarily a relationship between the different thoughts that you pay attention to during the day, right? They're just kind of random, right? So unlike the other thoughts, which have no essential interrelation, the I thought is equally and essentially related to each and every thought of the mind. And that's another thing we really want to pay attention to. Not only do people think of the I thought as the person when it's actually prior to creation entirely, people think of the I thought as just the word I or me, or maybe mine, I, me, mine, right? So if there were thoughts in the mind that had nothing to do with I, me, or mine, they might not think those were I thoughts. But if you realize that the I thought is consciousness itself, and that all of creation comes out of that I thought, then you realize that actually all of creation, including every thought that you receive in your mind, is at least the offspring of the I thought. Right, therefore it falls into the realm of the I thought. So unlike other thoughts which have no essential interrelation, the I thought is equally and essentially related to each and every thought of the mind. Without the I thought, there can be no other thoughts. But the I thought can subsist by itself without depending on any other thought of the mind. The I thought is therefore fundamentally different from other thoughts. Like I said, it's the first error, the first mistake. Mistake's maybe not a good word. The first step away, that's a better word. The first step away from the absolute. And so if you want to awaken to the absolute, you want to go back to that very first step. Because what's on the other side of that step? The threshold back to the absolute, right? So this is why, you know, remember the questioner was asking, why the I thought? Why are we questioning the I thought? Why don't we question some other thought? You know, like maybe I am bad, I am unsafe, right? And he's saying, because the I thought is the root of all illusion, right? It's the root of all creation. It's the root of all misperception, even the root of all perception. So you question the I thought, you go back to the very, very beginning of the I thought, and then you stay there, right? In fact, Billy this morning quoted Nisargadatta, cling to the I am, right? Cling to it, stay there. You hang with that I thought. You know, you hang out in that Buddhist hell, but you don't hang out in that Buddhist hell thinking this is it. You hang out in that Buddhist hell remembering that you're at the threshold and you want to be pulled across it, right? You know it's not it. And so even while you're there in that peaceful, silent state, you keep asking, what sees this? What am I? To whom does this appear, right? You continue with that inquiry because you want to be pulled across the threshold into the absolute. So Ramana Maharshi says, so then the search for the source of the I thought is the search not merely for the basis of one of the forms of the ego, but for the very source itself from which arises the I am-ness. In other words, the quest for and the realization of the source of the ego in the form of I thought necessarily implies the transcendence of the ego in every one of its possible forms. My heart is beating with excitement right now. So maybe I will tell you the book I'm going into next, because this conversation just leads right smack dab into that book. I'm going to go ahead and read from Bernadette Roberts next. We're going to be looking at, let me grab her books real quick. We're going to be looking at two books, just in case anybody wants to order them, and we may kind of flip back and forth between them, because they really go together almost as if they should have been one book, but they weren't. One book is What is the Self? By Bernadette Roberts, and the other book is The Experience of No Self by Bernadette Roberts. So these are the two books that we're going into now, next. And you know, Ramana Maharshi is just pointing there so straight away that I don't think we have a choice as to where we go next. Anything else would be like going forward, 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 and then let's back up. So I don't think we have a choice here. But what he is saying is, let me just read it again more slowly. So then, the search for the source of the I thought is the search not merely for the basis of one of the forms of the ego, but for the very source itself from which arises the I am-ness. Now, I want you to listen to that just for a moment, because so many people don't know this. You know, people aren't able to see what they aren't ready to see. Let's just put it that way, okay? So he has just said that we're searching for the very source of the I am. And then he says, all right, we're looking for the very source of the I am. You guys got that? And then he says, in other words, the quest for and the realization of the source of the ego. So what is he saying are the same thing there? The I am and the ego are the same thing. You see, most people don't put the ego and the I am together as the same thing. In fact, most people say that you awaken from the ego to the I am. Now, I agree that you awaken from the personal self to the I am. But Ramana Maharshi is still saying that is still ego. One moment. He told us this in a different way earlier in the book, much earlier in the book. He referred to anything but the absolute as impure mind. Impure. Now, impure is not a judgment. Impure just means not pure. You know, like, again, if you have a glass of water and you drop a couple drops of Coke in it, you no longer have pure water. You have water with a couple drops of Coke in it. Coca-Cola, I mean, not cocaine. I'm not encouraging. Right? With a couple drops of Coca-Cola in it. So anything before or below the first principle of God, he refers to as impure mind, as ego, right? So the second principle of God, the third principle of God, and the fourth principle of God are all illusion. Now, A Course in Miracles teaches the same thing, if you look at it carefully enough, because it talks all about the real world, but it's very clear that the real world is still a dream. Right? A dream, illusion, not truth. So there are so many people that teach that the I am presence is the awakened state. It is what A Course in Miracles would call the real world. You know, it's you could say, closer to truth than the deluded ego, personal self, ego mind. But it's not really yet awakening to truth. He says, again, very carefully, and this, of course, is what Bernadette Roberts is all about. You know, so that's why I said he's leading into Bernadette Roberts for us. In other words, the quest for, well, let me start one more sentence up. So then, the search for the source of the I thought is the search not merely for the basis of one of the forms of the ego, but for the very source itself from which arises the I am-ness. In other words, the quest for and the realization of the source of the ego in the form of I thought necessarily implies the transcendence of the ego in every one of its possible forms. Now, if you think of consciousness as the source of manifestation, if you transcend consciousness, you have just transcended the ego in every one of its possible forms. Because all of its possible forms come from consciousness, right? So again, this is awakening. All I can say is that most teachers, they don't seem to know. In fact, Bernadette Roberts says that's why she wrote her book. She says nobody talks about this. Everybody's talking about this first awakening, this unity consciousness. Nobody talks about the awakening to the absolute. And I think they don't talk about it because they don't know. They haven't opened up to that. They haven't realized that, right? You know, and they read this same book. You know, a lot of these people have read this book. But you can't hear what you aren't ready to hear. And so they don't see what he's saying here in this very last chapter of the book. I'll read it one more time and then we'll move on. But notice he's putting the I thought, the I am, and the ego as synonymous in this paragraph. So then, the search for the source of the I thought is the search not merely for the basis of one of the forms of the ego, but for the very source itself from which arises the I am-ness. In other words, the quest for and the realization of the source of the ego in the form of I thought necessarily implies the transcendence of the ego in every one of its possible forms. The devotee says, conceding that the I thought essentially comprises all the forms of the ego, why should that thought alone be chosen as the means for self-inquiry? I think actually Ramana Maharshi just answered that perfectly. But it's like I said, you can't hear what you're not ready to hear. And so, you know, although Ramana Maharshi gave an extremely clear answer, I'm certain lots of people have read this answer and not understood it. Therefore, it's not surprising that the devotee would hear the answer and not understand it, right? So again, the devotee says, conceding that the I thought essentially comprises all the forms of the ego, why should that thought alone be chosen as the means for self-inquiry? Ramana Maharshi says, ooh, here's a word I don't know, two words I don't know. And I may need you. Oh my goodness. Because it is one irreductible datum of your experience. Do you know what that means? Irreductible datum? If you do, unmute. If not, we'll look it up.
I think it means it's irreducible, that you can't find a way to break it into little parts.
Okay, thank you. That makes perfect sense. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to use that irreducible word because it makes a whole lot more sense to me. So because it is the one, and then it's the datum part, like thought or idea, do you know?
Yeah, like one little factoid.
factoid. Okay. So because it is the one irreducible fact of your experience. How's that sound? Good translation? Because it is the one irreducible fact of your experience. Because seeking its source is the only practical course you can adopt to realize the self. The ego is said to have a causal body. But how can you make it the subject of your investigation? When the ego adopts that form, you are immersed in the darkness of sleep. So, in the inquiry, we have to transcend all levels of sleep, right? We have to transcend all levels of sleep. In fact, you know, we are immersed in the darkness of sleep when we think that we're a person. When we awaken from I am the person, we aren't as immersed in sleep. We are one level closer to the truth. That's the unity consciousness awakening. But as A Course in Miracles says, that is still a dream. That real world is still a dream. And so we need to continue that awakening until we awaken to the absolute truth. The devotee says, but is not the ego in its subtle and causal forms too intangible to be tackled through the inquiry into the source of I thought conducted while the mind is awake? I'm going to read that again. His question didn't 100% make sense to me. But is not the ego in its subtle and causal forms too intangible to be tackled through the inquiry, like you're going through something, right? Through the inquiry into the source of aham verity or I thought conducted while the mind is awake. Isn't it too hard to tackle that while the mind is awake? So maybe he means while the mind is still active. We'll find out from Ramana Maharshi's answer, but I think that's what he means. When the mind is so active, isn't that just too dang hard? You know, assuming that is what his question means, it's a question we've probably all thought, right? If my mind is very active, if I still think I'm a person, if I'm still worried about this and that, you know, is it even worth the effort to practice self-inquiry? Aren't I too far gone? Doesn't something else need to happen first, you know, to make me a little more clear? Ramana Maharshi says, no, right? No, it's not too intangible to be tackled is what he's saying. No, don't believe that thought. And you can see what a trick that is. I mean, imagine if you believe the idea, my mind is just too much of a mess. I have to do something else before I start self-inquiry. And any of you who are at the Nisargadatta meditation retreat, the natural meditation retreat, we called it, we looked at some quotes by Nisargadatta. And one of the quotes that we looked at there was a very similar type of question. Because, you know, Ramana Maharshi uses the language self-inquiry. And Nisargadatta uses the language focus on the I am presence. But they're both talking about the same thing. Get all the way back to there, to Buddhist hell, and keep going, right? Keep going. Stay with the I am presence or stay with the self-inquiry until you transcend it. Or as the Course says, until God takes the last step and you fall into the absolute, right? So somebody was asking Nisargadatta if there were other things you had to do first before you began to meditate on the I am presence. And his answer was, no. The exact same thing that Ramana Maharshi is saying, no. So when we get these ideas, like let's say we have the idea, I need to be free of the I am bad thought first. Or I need to be free of the I am unsafe thought first. Or I just need to be free of all this chatter first. I mean, to heck with that level, I just need to be free of all this chatter first. Both Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi say, no. In fact, we'll read the rest of Ramana Maharshi's answer in a moment. But what Nisargadatta said was it was through focusing on the I am presence that that anything else that needed to be cleared away would be cleared away. So it's just delay to think that you need to clear all this stuff away before you can start this type of meditation. And in fact, I doubt you guys remember, but when we were in Gentle Healing Year One, we started awareness watching awareness meditation. And in fact, what I told you in class was, I didn't do it this way, right? I went through this 5-year purification period first. And then after that, I became aware of awareness and I began to practice awareness watching awareness meditation. But I also told you, but you don't have to do what I did. You can do both at the same time. You can practice awareness, watching awareness, and then also work on, you know, letting go of thought at the same time. And that's really what Nisargadatta has said, and it looks like what Ramana Maharshi is going to say. You don't need to go through different phases of spirituality to get yourself to a certain state of maturity or inner peace before beginning self-inquiry. Or staying with the I Am Presence. Now, at the same time, I will admit that sometimes you will find Ramana Maharshi telling people that sometimes you need to be ripe for self-inquiry. So is that a contradiction? The answer is no. You are ripe for self-inquiry when you are willing to close your eyes and do it. If you aren't willing to close your eyes and do it, you aren't ripe for it yet. So it's not that you have to meet certain criteria, like you have to have gone through purification, you have to be free of the I am bad thought, free of the I am unsafe thought, you know, a relatively quiet mind, general inner peace. There's not this checklist that you have to check off before you can begin, I'll call it right now, awareness watching awareness meditation. You begin awareness watching awareness meditation as soon as you're ready to close your eyes, as soon as you're willing to close your eyes and do it. Jay, did I see your hand? Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just had a question about that parallel track you're talking about. I actually just recently sort of got that teaching, and you're bringing it up here again. It relates to a statement I believe I heard. It said, do you have to be completely free of thoughts to awaken? And the answer was no. So I think that was somehow related to this parallel track that you're talking about. Could you clarify that a little bit?
If you read, I think it's probably in the Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, but I don't remember which Michael Langford book it's in, but in one of his books, he talks about the fact that everybody's experience of the final awakening, the final death of the ego, is different. You know, some people do reach this peace and they're in this relative quiet mind peace and they awaken from there. Some people's minds chatter up until the last moment. You know, so when we get the idea that I have to pass through these certain phases in order to awaken, we're wrong. And in fact, recently I made a post and I posted it in the forum where there's a little place there where it says something like Regina sometimes posts from her journal here. I think I've made like 3 posts. I made a post there that basically says, I don't know what my journey looks like. You know, I don't remember what I said. I don't remember how many forests I have to travel through. I can't remember how many deserts I might have to travel through. I don't know if there will be this long, quiet time of sailing on a peaceful sea. I don't know where the last curve is in the journey or whether awakening is just beyond that curve or if awakening is still some distance beyond the last curve. That's really important to know. You know, we don't know what our journey looks like, and our journey doesn't look like anybody else's. Right? So somebody else can tell you, like Regina can tell you, I went through this 5-year purification period and then I came to this state where I am relatively happy, very seldom see judgments in my mind, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't mean you'll ever reach that. You may awaken without ever reaching that. Isn't that amazing? You may go straight from judgment to awake. So to think that we know what this journey looks like is is just crazy. I mean, let me ask you this. What thinks it knows what the journey looks like? Right? Isn't that the mind? That answer your question, Jay? Yeah. Okay, good, good. So let me get a drink and then we'll go back and see what Raman is going to say here. So again, this devotee seems to be asking. By the way, I hear some noise. Facebook needs to be muted. Okay. It's almost like the noise. Did you hear the noise have to get in the last word? I said, maybe I heard this shh. And I said, I hear a noise. Maybe somebody needs to be muted. And the noise goes, like it had to get in the last word before it went away. All right, here we go. The devotee is asking, isn't the ego too subtle and, you know, too intangible to be tackled, you know, if my mind is still very, very active? Ramana Maharshi says, no. The inquiry into the source of the I thought touches the very existence of the ego. Therefore, the subtlety of the ego's form is not a material consideration. It doesn't matter. Think about that. It doesn't matter how hard it is to feel the I am presence or to be aware of awareness. You just do it anyway. And I will tell you, that's my primary experience during meditation. I would say every one of my meditations are different. If there was some way to be journaling and dictating, you know, what was happening in my meditation while I was meditating, you know, every day we'd have a different story. they're never the same. But there is one factor about meditation that is always the same for me. And that factor is I feel like something's happening. I can't tell you what. But I feel like something's happening. In fact, my friends there at the retreat house have probably heard me say that every time the bell goes off, no matter how long I meditate, I always feel like, oh, shoot, you know, like, dang it, it's over. Because I really feel like when I'm in meditation, something is going on. Notice I'm not telling you what is going on. I can't tell you what is going on. Some days the mind is more chatty. Some days it's quieter. Some days it feels like that self-inquiry, that looking is just zooming in there. Some days it feels like it can't quite find what it's trying to land on, right? The meditation itself is always different, but the consistent feeling is something's going on, right? At a level that the mind cannot be aware. And so I feel like meditation is the most important thing that I do. You know, and anybody who knows me knows that I meditate for the maximum now, finally, the maximum amount of time I can every day, whatever that is, you know. The devotee then says, well, the one aim is to realize the unconditioned, pure being of the true self, which is in no way dependent on the ego, how can inquiry pertaining to the ego in the form of I thought be of any use? Again, I'm hoping this is actually just a different devotee asking this, you know, the same question, because otherwise this devotee just keeps asking the same question over and over again. You know, how can inquiry into the I thought be of any use? Like, how in the world is that going to help me transcend the ego? Ramana Maharshi says, from the functional point of view of the form, activity, or whatever else you may call it, it is immaterial since it is, another word I don't know, Anne. Evanescent? Is that a word? No, I'm probably just pronouncing it totally wrong, so let me pull up the dictionary. She's like, I don't even recognize what the heck you're saying, Regina. Evan, where'd the word go? Essent, that's what it looks like, evanescent. Soon passing out of sight, memory, or existence, quickly fading or disappearing. soon passing out of sight or out of memory or out of his existence, quickly fading or disappearing. Did I say, do you know that word, Ann? Did I just say it wrong? No. Hey, I found a word Ann doesn't know. That's pretty cool. All right, I'm going to call it evanescent, because that's what it looks like, but I could be saying it wrong. From the functional point of view of the form, activity, or whatever else you may call it, it is immaterial since it is quickly passing, right? The ego has one and only one characteristic. The ego functions as the knot between the self, which is pure consciousness, and the physical body, which is inert and insentient. The ego is therefore called, oh boy, boy, now he goes into a bunch of Sanskrit words, chit jata granti. So let's look these words up. Chit is intelligence or consciousness. Jata is insentient. And granti well, it doesn't actually have that word here. I think granti means the knot of ignorance. What it has is granti nasam, which is destruction of the knot of ignorance. So I guess granti is the knot of ignorance, and the nasam is the destruction part. So we're talking about consciousness, insentient, knot of ignorance. How's that for a description of the ego? The ego is therefore called the consciousness, insentient, knot of ignorance. In your investigation into the source of the I thought, you take the essential consciousness aspect of the ego, and for this reason, the inquiry must lead to the realization of the pure consciousness of the self. So when you're focusing on the I am presence, right, you're focusing on the consciousness aspect of the ego. You're not focusing on the insentience, you know, which would be, focusing on the insentience would be focusing on the non-existence of the ego, which would be very hard, I would think, to focus on, the non-existence of it. Instead, it's easier to focus on the sense of existence to me. But you're not focusing on the non-existence part of the ego, and you're not focusing on the ignorance, the knot of ignorance, all of the minds, you know, all the mind thoughts. You're focusing on that sense of existence, the I am, the consciousness aspect of ego. And as you focus on the consciousness aspect of ego, you keep moving through consciousness, you know, kind of moving back in consciousness, back in consciousness, back in consciousness, until you reach pure consciousness, which would be prior to the I am, prior to the sense of self. And, you know, Michael Langford has a similar story in The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, where he talks about the dark mansion. He says, if you're lost in a dark mansion and you're looking for the daylight, you know, which would be outside the dark mansion, he says, which is, you know, basically, which is smarter to do? To go from dark room to dark room to dark room looking for the daylight, or to go in that one room where there seems to be like a tiny pinhole in the window shade and you can see a tiny pinhole of light and start following that tiny pinhole of light till you find out where it's coming from, right? And then you can open the shade, open the window, and find the daylight. So when we're focusing on our sense of existence, just, you know, what Michael Langford calls our everyday awareness, the awareness that wakes up in the morning, that's actually the tiny pinhole of light. That's not infinite consciousness. That's not pure consciousness. But you follow that to pure consciousness. And that's what Ramana Maharshi is saying self-inquiry is. When you're practicing self-inquiry, when you're asking who am I or what am I, what you are looking for is that sense of existence. But the sense of existence itself is still part of the ego. But you follow the sense of existence until you transcend the ego and you wake up into what he's calling pure consciousness, or what I call the first principle of God. I'll just read this again and then we'll stop. From the functional point of view of the form or the activity or whatever else you may call it, it is immaterial since it is so quickly passing. The ego has one and only one characteristic. The ego functions as the knot between the self, which is pure consciousness, and the physical body, which is inert and insentient. The ego is therefore called consciousness, insentience, not of ignorance. In your investigation into the source of the I thought, you take the essential consciousness aspect of the ego. And for this reason, the inquiry must lead to the realization of the pure consciousness of the self. And I will mark it there, and that's where we will begin next week. So I'm going to release the mic for Don. Thanks.